And now about sex.
No, now, not how.
You know this crowd.
How about sex? As most of
keep your clothes on, Troy.
Please. As most of you probably know, we got a bunch of new, we got some new people here who may not have seen this before. And one of the... I remember the first time I did a Joe and Charlie workshop. The one thing I came out of that workshop with was knowing the location of sex inventory in the Big Book. Everybody comes out of there saying it's primarily on page 69 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the one thing I remember coming out of that workshop. Many of us needed an overhauling there, but above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's easy to get off track, you know. In the middle of 69, the part I like is toward the bottom of that first paragraph. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. So in this sex conduct inventory, you know, the intent is not for you to come out of it. The intent of the sex inventory is to shape a sane and sound ideal for my future sex life, mine. Not Bob's, not Jeff's, not Marty's, you know, not Steve's, not anybody, not any of my sponsees, for myself. And it's personal. This whole idea is personal to each person. And check this out. My ideal can change. There's some young guys in here right now, and their ideal, newly sober, is I want to chill for a minute. I want to date. I'm not ready. Some people came out of a bad marriage or bad relationship, and that ideal can change 4 years from now. Somebody can be in here and say, I have no thoughts or desires to be in another marriage. You know, I just finished that relationship. Miss me with that. And 4 years from now, that can change. It's fluid and it's dynamic. This lifestyle that we're in, it's ever-changing, and it's ever-growing, and I'm ever-changing and growing. Don't limit yourself and don't cheat yourself. But this idea of sex inventory, it's a new way of looking. People subscribe. People read Cosmo and M and Mademoiselle and all kinds of books. And all the books on relationships always talk about how to find a mate, how to find the perfect mate, the things to look for in a mate, 20 signs of women, doing all this stuff. They got the dating sites and the rest of this and making somebody compatible. And the thing I like about the process of recovery, and it's consistent. It's consistent in all our steps. This process of recovery is not a looking outside process. It's not a looking outside myself exercise. Rather than me looking at the traits in a mate that I'm interested in, this idea of sex inventory has to do with what kind of mate do I want to become? The traits in myself that I want to bring to the table. Whether it's just as a partner that's dating, whether it's as a future husband or wife, whatever it is, there are people with alternative lifestyles. We are not in that, period. That's not my business. That's not my business. You know, and so what it is, and so sponsors, you know, it's amazing with sponsorship. Sometimes when I become a sponsor, it seems like I just automatically stayed at a Holiday Inn Express and I got an idea and opinion about everything. Yeah, I'm a marriage counselor. I'm a sex therapist. I'm a psychologist. I'm a shrink. I'm a psychiatrist. I'm a financial advisor. I'm all these things that I can't do for myself, but I can do it for all my sponsors. You know, I always say to anybody I work with, don't know about anybody else. My life is unmanageable by me. Yours damn sure is. That's not my job. My job is to get you in touch with a manager. Get you in touch with a manager. Because I got a manager. I got a manager, and it's not my sponsor. I was sponsored, and he's the sponsor. But I'm under new management, and we talked about that in the third step. And so this idea of sex inventory, reviewing and evaluating my conduct over the past. How do I do it? Well, the first thing I do is with everything. I look over past relationships when I do sex inventory. And I've inventoried every relationship of significance and many that were not of significance in my years, in the years I've been sober, because I do inventories on a regular basis. And some people will say, well, what about a 10-step? You know, and yes, yes. But I'm the kind of person that I'm messy. And it's, I liken it to a house. And we haven't got to the 10-step, so I'm previewing. But I liken it to a house. And if you clean up your house and you get it clean, and now you start every day washing the dishes, every day making the bed, every day picking up stuff. But see, every day I don't do the walls. And every day I don't go under the bed. And every day I don't mop the floor. And every day I don't go in every nook and cranny. I like to think of it, I had a mom that every year we did spring cleaning. That's the title of this workshop this week. So every year I do, because I don't see anything wrong with cleaning a clean house. But it might be something wrong with not cleaning a dirty one. So I do this business inventory. First time I did a sex inventory, I inventoried 6 relationships. And in the people I was working with at that time, they suggested, Ralph, you might want to look at anywhere from 3 to 6 people. I'm always on the greedy side. I told you I got interested in seeing what about this guy named Ralph. I got interested in it. So I looked at 6 of my past relationships. I looked at my ex-wife. I looked at who I was with at that time. I looked at 2 people I had two serious girlfriends. I looked at a married lady I'd had a relationship with. And I looked at a fling I'd had, because I wanted to see Ralph in all the various manifestations when I'm in relationships with somebody else. And sexual conduct inventory has nothing to do with inventorying sexual positions. We're not interested in a sober Kama Sutra deal, you know. That's not the deal. It's not an inventory of, you know, things that you didn't know. Sex conduct. And in the book, it says, I want to shape a sane and sound ideal for my future sex life. And there are 9 questions within the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that I ask myself. The first 8 questions look at my past conduct. The 9th question is a guide to my future, you know, behavior. Where have I been selfish? Where have I been dishonest? Where have I been inconsiderate? Where did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy? Where did I unjustifiably arouse bitterness? Where did I unjustifiably arouse suspicion? Whom did I hurt? Where was I at fault? What should I have done instead? I guess it would have helped me to show you guys where those questions were. But they're sitting up on 69. It says, we reviewed our conduct over the years past. And in that paragraph are the 9 questions I asked myself. And here's where it says one more time. He got this down on paper, and we looked at it. And we looked at it. Where have I been selfish? Well, isn't every? And we subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? Well, every relationship I've ever been in was selfish. Why would I be in it if it's not something in it for me? Is the first question that I ask. And I think that the question that the big book is posing when it says, was it selfish or not, it simply means this. Ralph, were you the only person present in the relationship? Sounds funny. Okay, some of you guys will get it after 5 seconds, you know. But somebody else has probably been in here and been the only person present. My opinion is the only one that counts. I don't pay any attention to your opinion. I don't pay any attention to your thoughts. I don't pay any attention to your desires. You do not have an understanding in this room. And some of the more serious ones, yeah, I thought I was like that. And some of the more casual ones, I had a relationship. I had a fling with a girl that was married. And all I wanted, I was selfish, because all I expected was for her to be available to me when it was convenient for me. You know, I was inconsiderate because I didn't think about her kids. I didn't think about my wife. I didn't think about it. So I asked myself those questions, and I asked them in just that way. And there's a level of selfishness, and there's a level of dishonesty in relationships. And the first and the most serious dishonesty in relationships between men and women usually starts with that, the dishonesty with myself. Dishonesty about things. Has anybody in here ever entered a relationship that I knew I wasn't going to be serious about, and you knew the other party wasn't going to be serious, and you both agree, yeah, we like each other, physically, and we made an agreement, nobody's going to get serious. I'm the only person that ever did that? Wow. You know. And then, when one or the other people wake up, and now I can't get rid of them because they're calling me all the time. I have the nerve to say, I was honest. I went in there saying exactly what it was. What makes me believe that I can have a verbal contract that's enforceable on feelings and emotions? Does anybody in here know feelings and emotions that can be restrained by a verbal contract. And there are all kind of levels of dishonesty underneath that. Because guess what? I'm going in here and I don't want anybody to be serious. But I got other character defects working at the same time. One of them is a fear that you won't like me. So I go into this non-serious relationship treating you like I want you to take me serious, right? And then when you, and so then, every now and then, it works. Every now and then it works. There are no complications. But guess what's the downside of that? It's probably because she didn't like you. Now I got this other thing going. Oh, man. So now I'm calling her because I want you to like me. And then when you like me, I like. So it's a cold thing. But there's so many levels of dishonesty in those kind of relationships. Somebody in here, we talked about fear. I have a fear of rejection that runs so deep I won't ask the question unless I already know the answer is going to be yes. So I do these categories in my head, and I think of girls who seem to be a couple of rungs below me, because if you're my level, and this is all subjective thinking, right? I shouldn't let you guys into my thinking, but that's my thinking. You know, and these, and so if you're my level or above, I'm scared of you and I won't approach you. But if you're a couple of rungs down here, ooh, yeah, she should be grateful to be with me, right? So now I'll ask you, because she's a fixer-upper and I can work with her, right? Well, the cool thing about having a fixer-upper is if she thinks of you as a fixer-upper, right? And you're in this deal, you know, so just this whole deal of human interaction and lying and the rest of that. And so sex inventory, that level of it, that's where I start. When I start asking myself, where was I dishonest? The dishonesty with myself. The idea that two people can lay down and one person won't wake up with feelings. That's a big dishonesty that people practice. And it's all kinds, and I wish I brought a hand up, but the way I do sex inventory is real simple. I answer those questions that they outlined in the book. I write them in a narrative form, and I just start answering. I was selfish because I never considered her views or her thoughts or opinions. I was selfish because I only wanted her to be available to me when I was available to her. I was dishonest because I led her to believe I was serious about this when all the time I knew I wasn't. I was dishonest because I told myself if we did this, nobody would be hurt. If we just laid down and went on about our business, nobody would get hurt. I hurt her kids by taking time from them that should have been spent with their mom. I hurt my kids by spending time with her that should have been spent with my kids. I hurt my wife by being with this woman when I should have been at home. I hurt my family by taking money from the house that should have been spent at home. I hurt my employer by taking off time and saying I was off, you know, I was sick because she had some time that day and we wanted to rendezvous. You know, I hurt my sponsees by going off with her when I promised this guy I was going to listen to this. So it's layers. It's layers. It's not just me and you that's involved. When I do the sex inventory, I do it comprehensively. And I do it, you know, and I unjustify the aroused jealousy because, you know, and aroused and jealousy, and you know, you could be married and you could unjustify the aroused, and that word is critical in there when you write about it, unjustify the aroused jealousy. You married, you do this deal, you got sponsees, somebody calls you and they in a bad way, and you laying in the bed, you both looking at a movie. People like Steve, and I know his wife, and she does this deal like he does, and you look at a movie and it's the best part and you're eating popcorn and it's romantic and I call Steve and say, Steve, I'm hurting, man. Can you come get me? I need to talk. And Steve jumps up. Now, Dawn might get mad, but that's not unjustifiably arousing jealousy. That's not unjustifiably. I got to know when to let somebody be in their stuff, you know. But by the same token, Dawn could be sitting up here, Steve sitting up there. Okay, baby, I'm tired. I don't want to do nothing. You wanted to go to the show tonight. I'm not going to go. Bob calls and says, hey, Steve, can you come over? We're going to play poker tonight. Steve gets up. That's unjustifiably arousing jealousy. Whole different deal. You see what that is? Whole different deal. Whole different deal. You know. So that's why that little thing. I used to say, why would they put in there unjustifiably arousing jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness? Because if you're in this deal, and if you're on this path, there are times when you'll be with a mate and you'll do some things that are the things that we do. That are the things that we do. And some of the time I have to say, the reason I'm the guy that you with is because I do these kind of things. You don't want me to stop. And I don't want you to stop. And I can unjustifiably get jealous of you going and working with one of your girls. But in the big picture, please go do that. Because that's why we are who we are. So that's the reason. So when you get to that question, whether I unjustifiably arouse it, that's why it's sitting in there like that. And I just do it in a narrative. And then I get to that ninth question. What should I have done instead? And I don't take a pass on I shouldn't even mess with them. That's part of it, but I want to know every step of the way. What should I have done? I should have been honest with myself. You know, I should have been communicative. I should have been, you know, I should have kept my commitments. I should, whatever it is, because I need to see how I need to act differently going forward. Everything in my life, you know, there are no mistakes in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful for every experience. Somebody says all the time, two things happen with any experience, lessons and blessings. Lessons and blessings. That's the only thing that happens. So don't get tripped out and don't get ashamed and don't get embarrassed about things that happen. Now I'm armed with some stuff that I get to share with somebody else and I get to benefit from going forward. Lessons and blessings. I'm done.
Bob, I'm an alcoholic. How many people in this room objectively think that they either haven't done this inventory the way it is in the book, or maybe they've done an inventory but they think now that they might have missed some stuff or maybe not really followed the format of the book? Okay. If you haven't done this, when you get to the beginning of it, the resentment section, it says resentment's the number one offender. If you're like me, it may feel like that's not true.
Hmm.
It may feel like guilt should be the number one offender, because most of us get sober and we have tremendous feelings of guilt. But oddly enough, guilt is a very small portion of the fear inventory, because all guilt incurs fear. Fear of karma, retribution, fear of what people think if they found out, fear of confrontation, all the different multifaceted fears that are around something that you would do that you feel guilty about. Fear of whatever. But resentment, oddly enough, seems to have a permanence that doesn't go away. You can't wish it away. I was a precocious kid growing up. I think I had that ADD before it came out. I don't know. I was always in trouble as a kid. You know, I was a kid from hell. And I did a lot of things, 10, 11, 12 years old, 13 years old, up until the time I found alcohol. I did a lot of crazy stuff. I think adrenaline was my first drug of choice, getting in trouble and trying to get away with it. And I did a lot of things that after I did it, I felt guilty. Do you know, I can't tell you what most of that stuff is today. I can't remember the incidences. Unless somebody made a big deal about it, I don't remember. Because the funny thing about guilt is, in time, one of two things happens. Either the feelings of guilt will drive you to face the fear and face the deal and make it right, kind of like making amends. You go to the store and you take the thing back you stole, or you, whatever the deal is, and then you're no longer guilty, or a significant period of time goes by, and no, you can't, there's not a number you can put on that, but there's a point somewhere, chronologically, where you're far enough away from the incident that you felt guilty about, where there's absolutely now no way in the world there's ever going to be any retribution. You're really out of the woods. You ever notice when you get in that zone, you're no longer guilty? You kind of forget about it. But resentment, I could tell you stuff my second grade teacher did to me. I could tell you things my parents did to me preschool. I got files on these people in my mind. And do you ever notice when you get a resentment, from the moment, what is a resentment? Isn't it a judgment towards someone? I'm judging them to be fill in the blank. And do you ever notice from the moment you get the judgment, the resentment, it alters your perception. And from that moment on, you can't observe them doing anything good. They can't do anything right from that moment on. And if someone comes and tells you something that the person you resent did that was wonderful, you'll discount it. Oh, they're just phony. They're just doing that to show off. You'll find a reason to make them wrong again. It can't be right. It can't be, because you are. The ego demands that it's right. And it alters my perception. I freeze frame those people. Isn't it bizarre that you can have a resentment that's 30 years old, and in your mind, they're the same exact person they were 30 years ago? Somebody can tell you, somebody come up to you and tell you they changed. Nah, geez. They're the same SOB that they were 30 years ago. Now, that's ludicrous. There's no reality in that because people change. That's the one thing you can count on in life is change. You can't escape it. You could try, you ever try not to change? Life will just wear your ass out. It'll wear you out. And so I'm freeze framing these people and they never change. Some of us are very defended when it comes to stuff like this. Especially guys. There's a lot of guys that are so defended that they don't want to admit even to themselves that they have resentments. They don't want to admit that anyone could have actually ever hurt them. As if you're bulletproof. I was working with a guy who was, this is 9 years ago. A guy with 23 years of sobriety. He's actually sober a little longer than I was. Came to me and asked me to sponsor him. And he was 23 years sober and he hadn't done anything in the steps. He didn't sponsor anyone. He'd done, when he was brand new, a kind of a life story inventory that did nothing for him. And then they've never done anything since. Well, he's got 23 years of untreated alcoholism. And he is insane. I'll tell you how crazy he is. He's going to commit suicide, and he's perfectly okay with that. He's glad to do it. The problem is, and the reason he came to me for help, is in the process of planning his suicide, the obsession to drink returned. Which I understand, if you're going to kill yourself, you might as well get drunk first, right? Because it might hurt. You need some anesthetic on the way out. I mean, I understand that. Now, he don't mind killing himself. He can't stand the idea that after he's dead, everybody's going to know he lost his sobriety and going to be talking about it. He don't mind dying, he just don't want to look bad. So he comes to me and asks me for some help. So we start going through the steps. We did a third step on our knees after talking about the third step for a while. And I told him, I said, I want you to get a tablet and I want you to start listing all your resentments. This guy's kind of a blustery guy. He's an ex-Navy chief. Oh, he's the kind of guy who talks to you like this all the time. I said, I want you to list your resentments. He said, I don't have any resentments. I said, really? Now, anybody who knows this guy knows he's uptight about a lot of stuff, man. You don't even have to know him. Watch him walk across a parking lot from 100 yards away and know he's uptight. I said, you don't have any resentments. He said, I just let that stuff go. Don't mind me. So what I said to him next was, I think, inspired. I think it came from God because I didn't know to say it. I said to him, okay, Jerry, I said, in your case, we're going to do something different. I want you to make a list of people you feel smugly superior to. And he got this look on his face like, oh, my God, that's a long list. And what are we doing? Aren't we really making a list of people we built cases against? People we have judgments against. And then we list in the second column, as Ralph was talking about so eloquently, the things in us that were hurt, threatened, affected, injured, what they did. No, column number two is the bullet points of what they did as we build our case against them. We're really putting the case down that we have inside us anyway. Mm-hmm. Column number two. And the only value of the first three columns is in column number one, column number two, I separate the person from the things they did. And what an interesting thing is when you start thinking about it, if they hadn't have done what was in column number two, you wouldn't hate them. It's not the person you hate, it's what they did. Right? That in itself has a little value. And then what was the manifestations of self? And that's what column number three is, the manifestations of self. You know why it's manifestations of self? Because here's how it talks about column number three. We're looking for our self-esteem, my self-esteem, my pocketbook, my ambitions, my personal relationship, my self-esteem, my security, my sex, me. It's all aspects of me. We're looking for, as it said, in the beginning of the inventory, the manifestations of self which have been defeating us. Now, this in of itself is of no value, except to maybe see that how self-centeredness has set us up and how the person isn't what we hate their actions. But this case we've built on these people is necessary in order to dismantle. You can't dismantle something you're not aware of. So in order to dismantle the judgment machine that is your ego, you have to put it out in paper. And we're going to start to discover something that may be hard on some of us. We're going to start seeing that the exact nature of our wrongs was how wrong we had been about everybody in our whole life. Chances are there are people in this room that are like me. The idea of being wrong is unpalatable. And if you can't stand being wrong, you're going to have a hard time recovering from alcoholism. Because it's a lot of what we do here. It's changing our perception to see the truth. To see past the story we've told ourselves in our head about what happened, to see what really was going on. We call it an awakening. We awaken to the truth. A truth we didn't know. The book promised in the beginning, Ralph covered it with fact-finding, fact-facing, to discover the truth about stock and trade. We're going to wake up to some stuff we've never woke up to before. I think alcohol is to have untreated alcoholism is to be asleep in your own life, living in the daydream in your head that you tell yourself about your life and being actually disconnected from it. Alcoholics don't live in reality. We live in a story about reality. That's why in AA we have a book. As Bill sees it, Al-Anon has Lois remembers. As we see it, well, what's that have to do with reality? Well, not much, but it's what I think. You ever have the experience? I sat down with my sister. Now, my sister's not an alcoholic. She's a pretty level-headed person. We sat down one time. We're talking about our childhood. And I'm aghast. I'm wondering, where did she grow up? Her perception of our childhood was so different from mine. And I want to straighten her out, except I restrain myself. Because in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, you know, if one of the two of us' perception's wrong, I wonder who's that might be. Huh? What are the odds that it would be her with my track record? I tell myself stories about my childhood. My friend Sandy says something. He's sober 40-some years. He says it's amazing. The longer he's sober, the nicer his childhood becomes. And some people are like, oh, you're deluding yourself about it. No, you're starting to see the truth. You've deluded yourself. You were deluded coming in here. As your ego told you the stories to make you right. Have you ever seen the movie Two Towers, the second Lord of the Rings? There's a scene in there that it's like me and my ego. And the scene is when King Theoden has been possessed by the spirit of Saruman. And his emissary is a guy called Wormtongue, who sits next to the king and just chatters to him about how wrong. Don't listen to those people in AA. They don't know what they're talking about. Your sponsor's stupid. Don't listen to him. It's Wormtongue. Just chatters.
Wormtongue
is the name of the character in the movie. I thought it was apropos. Wormtongue. So we list, and then on page 66, I'm not going to read this, it just goes, it really spends the whole page hammering in a point, and it hammers it in, I think, 7 times that this stuff's fatal, it's going to kill us. It uses all kinds of terminology, it's grave, it's poison, it's infinitely grave, it's
we're going to die. Sets us off from the sunlight of the Spirit. Just to get to a point in the second to last paragraph in the second line, it says we are prepared to look at these things from an entirely different angle. Are you surrendered enough that you would rather be free than right? If you still need to be right about the people in your life, you're not going to move on. You're stuck. To have active alcoholism feels like being stuck. Stuck in the same reoccurring emotions. Did you ever notice when you change cities that the same idiots show up? They have different faces, but you're stuck. It's like, alcoholism is often like that movie Groundhog Day, you know, where it's just... The worst thing about alcoholism is it gets worse, 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 and then it gets the same. It's the same. You're stuck. Are you prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle? All these judgments, are you prepared? So in order to look at it from an entirely different angle, how do you do that? Well, first of all, to see what an entirely different angle would be, I think you have to kind of get the angle you're looking at it from to start with. You can't make a 180 degree turn from a point you can't find on the compass. You have to find the point first in order to go 180 degrees from it. So how am I looking at it? Well, aren't I looking at it as if I'm a prosecuting attorney? So what would be an entirely different angle from a prosecuting attorney? Wouldn't it be to cross the courtroom and sit on the defense table and now start to look at it from the perspective and the perception of the people on the defense table? How did it look to the person you're judging so harshly? What had happened between you and them? I know one thing. I bet you it looked different than it. I bet you the story they're telling themselves and their experiential reality was different than yours. How did it look to them? If you were pleading their case, how would you plead it? Well, and trying to be genuine and realistic and honest, what would you say if you were looking at it from their point of view? The book goes on to a couple lines down. It says, in the state, we see how the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoings of others fancied or real had the power to actually kill. Now, they're starting to slip something in on us here. An implication that some of these stories I've told myself about people to some degree, if not totally, are fancied. Now, the ego, if you're like me, my ego balks at that. Man, I just want to be right about that stuff. But am I prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle? Fancied or real, and it says that even fancied resentments have the power to actually kill you. I'll tell you a story. When I was fairly new in sobriety, I used to go out to coffee with people after meetings quite often. And there was a guy named Billy Taylor. Billy was an old-timer in AA, sober quite a while. And I sat in a coffee shop with him one night, and I told him my secrets. You know, the stuff that you're ashamed of, the stuff you don't want anybody to know about, the sleazy, disgusting, embarrassing, humiliating, pathetic stuff that your skin kind of crawls when you think about what you did. You feel ashamed of yourself. We all have stuff like that. I don't know what yours is. Maybe you went out to party with some people one night. You left your kids at home. You didn't come back for a long time, and you shudder to think what might have happened. Maybe hungover one time when you were really sick and hated yourself, or maybe really drunk in a drunken rage. Maybe you beat your kids. Maybe occasionally you still see that look of terror in their eyes as they cowered from you. Maybe you let somebody else take the blame for something you did, and it cost them dearly, and they never knew that you really did it. Maybe you did something repeatedly to hurt people who loved you until you know you just broke their heart, and they'll never be the same.
Maybe you had sex with someone you wouldn't even want anybody to know you had lunch with. Maybe you had sex outside your species. I don't know what your thing was. I just know every alcoholic comes here with something they're ashamed of. People they disappointed and let down. Lies they told. A sense of phoniness and a fear of being found out. So I told Billy my stuff, my deepest, darkest secrets, the things I was the most ashamed of. And he didn't reject me. But I'll tell you something, it would have helped if he would have said, me too. He didn't say that. What he said instead was, I'm sure you're not the only one that ever did that. Someday that might help somebody. Little AA party line sounding like stuff, you know. But I he didn't reject me, so I didn't think nothing of it. Went home that night. My shift got changed. I'd been working 8 to 4, and now I was working 4 to midnight. Well, my whole meeting schedule got turned upside down. Now I'm going to noon meetings for the most part. And a good part of a year went by, and I hadn't seen Billy, just hadn't run into him because I don't go to the same meetings anymore. And one night, on my night off, I went to a meeting I normally wouldn't go to, and he was in the meeting. And he was across the room from me, and the meeting was getting ready to start, and I saw him, and I was delighted to see him. I hadn't seen him in a long time. I was lit up, and, hey, Billy, how you doing? And he wouldn't say hi to me. Matter of fact, he looked at me with a look that appeared to be disdain. A look that kind of said, you. And then he couldn't even look at me anymore. He turned away and sat down. And the meeting started, and I know exactly what's going on. I know that SOB's been judging me for that crap. And I got to tell you, there's a part of me that didn't blame him. God knows I judged myself harshly enough for that stuff. And I think somewhere I always secretly believed if you knew about me what I knew about me, you'd feel about me the way I feel about me. I think that's why I kept a lot of my life secret. I'll take the self-rejection. I just can't hear it in you. And I knew he'd been judging me for that stuff, and I was hurt. But I don't stay hurt. I got this knee-jerk reaction when I get hurt is I get angry. It's like a defense mechanism with me. And so I'm starting to get angry. And I'm starting to cook, man. I'm thinking about that hypocritical guy, man, telling me all that stuff. He's been judging me. And then in the midst of the anger, I had this epiphany-like experience where all of a sudden I got this real clarity, and I thought, oh, my God, the reason he can't look me in the eye, he's been telling people that stuff. And it became very clear to me. I had just asked a girl out and who would not go to coffee with me, and he knows her. I knew he had told her that stuff. There was another guy who runs around with him, and he'd been a little distant, a little kind of standoffish lately. I knew he told that. Now I'm enraged. By the end of the meeting, I am prepared to go beat the crap out of this guy and be justified doing it. Because if he's doing that to me, he's probably doing it to other new people. The meeting's getting ready to shut down, and the chairman says, anybody have a burning desire? And this guy, Billy Taylor, raises his hand and tells everybody in the room that the biopsy came back and the tumor's accelerated, malignant, and he has a very short time to live. And I sat there and I felt about this big as I realized what had happened. But on the day he found out that he was terminally ill, saying hi to Bob was not a big deal. That he was so afraid at his imminent death, as I would be, that he was so far up in his head scared that he didn't even notice me or anybody else was there. That the look of what appeared to be disdain and pain on his face had nothing to do with me. That he'd never said or thought anything negative about me. All he'd ever done was love me. It was like a postcard from God. Dear Bob, you don't know crap. Love God. Here's the horrific part of this. I shudder to think what would have happened to me if I would have attacked a man who had done nothing but try to help me on the absolute lowest day of his life. And then found out what I had done. I am convinced I would have had to go drink myself to death. Because I couldn't have come in back into these rooms and faced him and all the people who loved him after what I did. It would have killed me. And you know the tragic, pathetic part of it is I would have died over nothing. Over an imagined resentment. And I'll tell you why this is important. Because a couple of years later, I'm going to do an inventory out of the book, and I knew something. I knew that I can be really, really wrong and think I'm right. And if I could be that wrong about Billy Taylor, was it possible that I could have been that wrong about my mother and father? Was it possible that I could have been that wrong about the police? Could I have been that wrong about some of the women I was involved with? Could I have been that wrong? Or do I still need to be right? The ego just freaks out with some of this stuff. It just freaks out. You ever see there was an episode of Happy Days when the whole half-hour series was about the Fonz trying to say the words "I'm wrong." He couldn't say them. He kept going. Couldn't say it was wrong. I spoke to guys. I go to tell them to make amends. They come back and say, "Oh, I made amends." What'd you say? I said that it was a shame that that happened to him. Did you say you were wrong? They don't want to say they're wrong. They don't want to say the words "I was wrong." They want to say it. It's like I'm the kind of guy that goes, ends up in court, and I say, "Guilty, Your Honor," but with an explanation, right? I don't want to admit that I'm wrong, and yet a lot of my recovery is based on how wrong I've been. If you want to get a change of perception, you have to see how wrong your present perception is. So what do we do? The bottom of page 66, after it spends all this time telling me this stuff's going to kill me, it says, how could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered. Oh my God, I can see it. It spent a whole page telling me they're going to kill me. I'm going to drink again. And for me to drink is to die. How can I escape? They must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. The self-knowledge that you have them doesn't help. I think we play a deadly game in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the deadly game is you come here and after, because of our desperate need for acceptance and to fit in AA, we learn in very short order that resentments are bad, so we just decide we don't have any and we're never going to have them again. That's not how you get free. That's how you build an ulcer. Right? So what do you become? You become the pretend guy. Oh, nothing bothers me. I'm just going to go home and think of how you should die. I don't have a resentment. I just have conversations in my head with you all the time when you're not around. It's not a resentment. I don't have a resentment. You really are an asshole. We can't wish them away any more than alcohol. What do we do? And here's what it says. This to me was the part of this process that changed my life the most. I've never been the same since this. It says, this was our course. And it's asking me to make a realization. In other words, to make something real within me that had never been real before. This is where I start to discover the truth. This is where I start to find and face the facts I could never find and face before. This is where my perception starts the 180-degree turn. It's asking me to realize that the people who wronged me were perhaps spiritually sick. Yeah, I can see that. They're sick and they're idiots too. That's not all it says. In the next line, this is where it nailed me. It says, though we did not like their symptoms, what's the symptoms? Column number 2. Would these people that I would have loved if they hadn't done in column number 2, if they would have been themselves, and the person I loved, would they have been capable of doing what they did in column number two? Though their symptoms, column number two, and the way their symptoms disturbed me, column number three, what was affected, hurt, threatened, injured, interfered with. And then here's the kicker. I'm supposed to realize how they are like me, perhaps spiritually sick. This is not a well person looking down on a sick person. You know what this is? This is two cancer patients in a cancer ward, both suffering at different times, recurring symptoms of the chemotherapy that both painfully manifest themselves in the individuals in different manners. And as now you're having a bad day with the chemo, and I look at you and I go, my God, I'm so sorry. I know you're irritable, and I know it's not you. I know you threw your tray across the room. I remember last week when the pain of the chemo was on me, and it made me nuts. It's seeing yourself in that person. It's really realizing what would have to be going on within me to make and drive me to do what you had done to me. How would I have had to have been abused as a child? How would I have had to have been hurt in order to make me hurt you the way I hurt you? What would have had to, how sick would I have had to be? How sick then consequently were you when you did to me what you did? And all of a sudden what happens is I start to get you. I start to wake up to the reality here of what's really going on. All I've been seeing is the symptoms and how they annoyed me. Now I start to get you. I start to wake up. I start to have something that most of us never have. A thing that's a word that's thrown around the English language. Most people don't know what it means. The word's compassion. It comes from two Latin words, com meaning with and passio meaning pain. In other words, now I'm sitting with your pain. See, I get you. I know why you did to me what you did. My God, I would have done the same thing. If I'd have been scared like you were scared, if I'd have been hurt and abused like you'd been hurt and abused, if I'd been angry and frustrated, if I'd been lonely and driven and vacant, I could have easily done to you what you did to me. And then all of a sudden, the great awakening is I'm awakening to the me that is in you. See, the guy I hate, that's me. It's me on a bad day, but it's me. That's me. That's me. There's an old American Indian story about an earthworm, a big earthworm, that is territorial, and it's staked out a big plot of earth that's rich with minerals. And it burrows through the earth doing its deal and kind of making sure there's no other earthworms in its territory. Animals sometimes are territorial. One day it's coming around this little rock and it's in its territory and it runs into another earthworm. Well, it starts getting a little aggravated. There's another earthworm in its territory. So they start, you know, positioning and posturing towards the other earthworm. The other earthworm is positioning and posturing back. So finally it attacks the other earthworm. And it realizes it attacked its own tail. Right? If what Einstein said is true, when I'm in conflict with you, I'm in conflict with me. Isn't it funny that every time I've hurt you, somewhere down the road I had to hurt me? There's no free lunch here. One of the great things about Alcoholics Anonymous is we get to change our karma. I didn't know what karma meant until just a couple years ago. I was listening to a brilliant, brilliant theologian and scholar, a guy by the name of Alan Watts, do a series for PBS. And he's an amazing guy, very learned in every religion in the world. And he said something I never knew before. I was talking about karma. And I always thought karma was how the universe will spank you or slap your hand for being out of line. And Alan Watts said that's not what karma means at all. Karma literally translated out of the Hindi into the English would be the word doing. In other words, you hurt these people over here. So it is your doing that you're unconsciously sabotaging your life over here. And the problem is you're asleep and you think life's doing it to you. You're doing it to you. And you don't even know it. And you don't even know it. The reason you're having problems in business and money is because you never paid back those people over there. The reason you're having problems in relationships is because look at the people you've hurt. The reason is always connected. There is a unity in the universe. Everything is connected. Nothing happens by mistake. It comes from Dr. Paul's story in the book. Nothing happens in God's world by mistake. It's all connected. It's all one. And so I start to realize and wake up to what's really going on here. And isn't it odd that we make these lists of people that we resent, that we're unconsciously, aren't we really making a list of people we suspect owe us an amends? These are the people that hurt me. And you come out the back side, and what happens? They're on your amends list. It seems unfair. They trick you into it. But you wake up to the truth. We wake up. And then the last part, referring to our list, again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others have done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. I refer to this part of the book when I was sponsoring guys and talking in meetings about this is where we look for our part. And that's okay if you want to look at it that way, that's fine. But I ran into trouble with that. And here's the trouble I ran into. I was talking to this guy sponsored about, we're going to go clear up your side of the street and deal with your part in this deal. Well, he goes to make amends to this guy for his part, and he gets pissed because after he made amends, the guy never cleared up his part because he's still unconsciously holding on to the reservation that you had a part, as if your part made my part. What's that old unconscious thing we say to ourselves sometimes, like, look what you made me do. Right? Look what you made me do. The book says we disregard the other person involved entirely. Where are we to blame? Later on, it's putting out of our minds the wrongs others have done. So what if I really did that? What if I really pushed out all their bad behavior? It's not on the board anymore. It's not on the table. I can't look at that. I disregard it completely. I put it out of my mind. Now, what kind of a son was I? What if I had perfect parents? What if there is no mistakes in God's world and everything was perfect and I just had to look at what kind of a son I was in the light of a perfect world? What kind of a son was I? Oh my God, if I can't use the things my parents did wrong, I was a bad kid. I made their life hell. And I used things I found wrong with them to justify my position. I was a terrible boyfriend. I was a terrible employee. I was a terrible brother. I was a terrible friend. And I looked diligently for your mistakes so I could justify myself. I could justify my own selfish behavior. But what if I start looking at this stuff in its own light? For some of us, it's the first time in our life we ever stood up away from the justifications and the rationalizations and really looked at ourselves dead on. Dead on. How do we look to the people on the other side? I realized that I never saw myself the way other people saw me. There's a line earlier in the book that says, sometimes people hurt us, seemingly without provocation, seemingly without any reason. But we will invariably find, and this is where we find it, we will invariably find that we have made decisions based on self, which later placed me in that position to be hurt. So in that light, I start to ask myself these questions. Looking for my own mistakes. Where had I been selfish?
where had I been dishonest with you? Where had I lied to myself or I lied to you? Where had I been self-seeking, where really it was just about me and obtaining and getting for me and doing for me? Where was I frightened? Where was I so afraid that I wasn't going to get my own way, that I pushed and controlled? Where did I talk about you behind your back, trying to get my own way? What did I do? Though a situation had not been entirely my fault, I tried to disregard the other person entirely. Where was I to blame? The inventory was mine, not the other person's. There's a prayer that comes with "This Was Our Course," and the prayer is a call for action. And it's asking, I'm asking God to help me to take some actions, to help me to show them, which means to demonstrate towards them or to act towards them, to show them the same patience, pity, and tolerance I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. If I could take away everything in column number two, is it possible that that person, if they hadn't have done that, or if they were forced by emotions or a sickness in their heart beyond their control to do what they did to hurt me, and I can have the compassion, and that's not the issue anymore, would they be my friend? Could I have the same compassion, tolerance, pity, patience? Am I willing to act towards them that way? And I ask God to help me to do that. I'll give you two little quick examples. Maybe I'll have time for one. I'll give you one. A lot of people relate to this. I got two of them that people relate to. I'll give you the first one. You do things in AA. Sometimes you don't know why you're doing them. You do all kinds of stuff. You do service and inventory, and you're sponsoring guys, and you're helping people with the steps, and you have no idea why you're doing it, and then all of a sudden something slams you out of nowhere. Maybe it's self-induced, and you don't even get it because you were asleep in your life, and you made decisions based on self, and now something's coming at you. You're getting crushed in sobriety by a self-imposed crisis you could not postpone or evade. And little did I know that I'm spending years building a weapon that I don't even know that I need until the day I need it. When I was a little over 10 years sober, I was married for 4.5 years to a gal in AA. We had a daughter that was about 2 years old at the time, who I was absolutely in love with, and I am to this day. She took my heart. I was there when she was born and gave her her bath and was the first human being to help hold her, and I fell in love with her and have never stopped. And I'm over 10 years sober, and my wife comes to me one day and wants a divorce. Here's how self-centered I am. I'm so wrapped up in working, building this company that I'm building and doing all my many AA commitments and sponsees and all that stuff that I don't even know there's a problem in the marriage. I think everything's fine. I'm asleep in my own life. So now she's asking me for a divorce, so I get a hint there could possibly be a problem here, I suppose. Well, I talk her out of it. I talked her into it. Let's try to fix this. I'm a fixer. Let's try to fix it. We'll go to marriage counseling. I started going to marriage counseling. Well, my sponsor at the time, my first sponsor, had retired. He bought a bus. He was all over the East Coast. He didn't have a cell phone. He was in pretty much incommunicado. So I'm going through a rough patch of road, and I'm using one of my sponsees as my confidant with all this stuff, and go to the marriage counseling, and then I talk to him, tell him what's going on. Well, after a couple months of marriage counseling, my wife comes to me one day, and she says, "I don't want any more marriage counseling, I want out." I live in Las Vegas, and Vegas, an uncontested divorce happens so quick. You can get divorced so fast in Vegas that you've been single for 2 weeks and you haven't even got the visa bill for the divorce yet. And that's how fast, it's quick. And we were divorced on a Thursday. I find out Friday, the next day, that my daughter and my ex-wife of one day moved in with my sponsee, my confidant, for all my marriage problems.
And then I discovered that they'd been sleeping together for the whole last year of my marriage, and it seemed like everybody in AA knew about it except me. Now, I'm over 10 years sober, and you guys have been telling me for 10 years there's no such thing as a justifiable resentment.
I got one now.
I'm even getting old-timers in AA to agree with me. You know, I had some old guy, I was telling him about my tale of woe. He says to me, "Didn't you just buy her a new car, Bob?" I said, "Yeah, I did." And the nail holes from the cross in my hands opened up a little bigger. And if you're like me, you know, this being hurt and being a victim stuff, the ego shine of that wears off very quickly. And you start to get real sick. And I started to get real sick. Scary sick. Scary like maybe drink again sick. Bad sick. Frightening stuff. And I don't know what else to do. I tried to do this inventory right away and I couldn't do it. It was like like some damaged sore or a bruise or something. You can't touch it until it has to heal a little bit before you can even touch it. I couldn't touch it. Sat down, tried to write it, but I couldn't do it. And God was very, very gracious to me through droves of guys sober a long time and newcomers that were all going through relationship breakups. I'd fill my car with these knuckleheads. We'd go to the meetings and be like the depressed section of the meeting. You could hear
the secretaries telling the chairman, "Don't call on them."
But they bought me islands in my day. Where I would be, I'd be so wrapped up in their pain that I was free from mine. Temporary. And I was eventually able to come back and after a period of time and do this resentment process on what had happened. And I'll tell you something, I didn't like what I saw. I listed both their names. I listed in column two the cause, what they had done, the infidelity, the lies, etc., etc. Column three, what had been hurt, threatened, injured, affected, interfered with, or everything, every aspect of self, everything from pride to pocketbook, everything had been, everything. And then it says, am I prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle? Am I prepared to look at it through their eyes? And I was, thank God I was like the rat. I don't want any more cheese, I just want out of this trap. I wanted to be free of this. I really wanted to be free of it. It was eating my lunch. And I started to look at it through both of their eyes. And when I started to look at it through the eyes of my ex-wife, I was embarrassed at what I saw. What I saw was a woman who fell absolutely in love with a guy and she wanted to spend the rest of her life with him. And unfortunately, she fell in love with a guy who at the time had grown up enough to know how to do a relationship. A guy who worked 70 hours a week under the guise that he didn't know how to do a relationship, so at least he'd be a good provider. A guy who had such alcoholism that when he had to do all these commitments and go to meetings, and she found herself in short order married to someone she built her whole life around but who just wasn't very much. And I started to get a sense of her loneliness and desolation in the marriage and how it must have ground on year after year. You see, I don't know anything's wrong because my life is full and satisfied. But I was her life and her life was desolate. And I'm too wrapped up in me to even see it. And then when I really woke up to what was going on with her, I remember thinking to myself, my God, how did she go as long as she did? I could easily see how I could have had an affair. And she had an affair with the guy who was around the most, my favorite sponsee. And when you get the compassion, you also get the price they pay. That's what I always hated about when people hurt me. I don't mind if you hurt me, if you're properly ashamed of yourself. What drives me crazy is if you hurt me and when I look at you, all I see is your defense mechanisms and it looks like you haven't paid a price. That's what makes me nuts. And I started to get the price she paid. It was a horrible price. I'll tell you in a minute what that price was, and I saw it when I went and made amends to her. When I put myself in his position, it was easy. I mean, he's a guy. I mean, the most noble, honest, honorable intention guys in the world in a compromising situation with a woman where a woman's touched him and made moves on him, you can't find those. Where's those noble intentions? They were here a minute ago. I mean, if anything, if wisdom incurs anything, it doesn't mean that you get better. It's you stay out of situations where you're going to do something you don't like yourself for. And I could get him. He said he could, his first couple years of sobriety, he couldn't even get a date with anybody. He said to me one time, he said, God, Mom, if just someday I could have what you have with Karen. I didn't know he meant specifically. I thought he meant more in a generalized way. And then when I got what had happened to him and what I really got what he must have felt like after he caved, my God, I was his sponsor. He almost lost his sobriety overnight. It haunted him for years and years. I think it still somewhere affects him to this day. Many, many years later. When I went to make amends to both of them, the most dramatic one was my ex-wife. I went to her to reduce the separation, admit where I was selfish, dishonest, afraid. I told her how afraid I was when Kate was born. How I'd never been responsible for even myself in my life. Now I got a wife and kids. It was made me nuts. And when I get afraid, I don't know what else to do, so I stay busy. I just worked harder. You know, threw myself harder into AA and harder into work, which fed her problem, and I didn't know that. And I said to her at one point, I told her, I said, I'm so sorry that I was so wrapped up in myself that I never understood how lonely you must have felt in that marriage. And I said to her, I know that you by nature are not the kind of person that would have ever cheated on her husband. I am sorry that I was absent enough to have driven you to that. And she started crying. Because all she ever wanted me to do was get it. She just wanted me to get it. We're very good friends to this day. She's actually becoming a minister. She didn't go to AA anymore. I don't think she's alcoholic. She hadn't been to an AA meeting in 12 years, probably. She's a minister, and in my small way, I may have driven her to the Lord. I don't know. And we're very close friends. She calls me up and asks my advice about stuff and talks to me about what's going on with her. We're very close friends. And Craig and I are close friends again, too. I actually, after a little while, started sponsoring him again, which is amazing. This is really crazy. There was a point in there where they got married because they were driven to it. It was like everybody judged them very harshly. And part of my amends to both of them was to go around and tell the truth about what had happened, how it was really me that set that whole thing up. And it was. If I would have hired a board of the most brilliant psychologists and sociologists in the world, at the day I got married to Karen, I would have set them down. I said, listen, you've got to give me a game plan that I can implement over the next couple of years that will make this loyal woman cheat on her husband. Can you give me a game plan? I'm telling you, they couldn't have given me anything more effective than what I did over the next couple of years. And yet, I don't even get it because I'm asleep in my own life. I don't even get it that I did that. And this is where I started to wake up to it. You know, they say the truth will set you free, but sometimes it messes your day up first. Let's take a 9-minute, 12-second break.